Thank you all for coming to this afternoon session of the Conference on World Affairs. Our panelists today will be talking about the controversial issue of evolution versus creationism. I'd like to briefly introduce those panelists, and then we can move on to their presentations, an exchange between the panelists, and ultimately question and answer with the audience. Our first panelist is the Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic from the Chicago Sun-Times, Roger Ebert. Ebert is known for his co-hosting of the television show Ebert and Roper. If you haven't seen him dissect films like La Dolce Vita, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's on your programs, and I highly recommend it. Our second panelist is Dan Odeskalki. Dan is president of Strategic Advantage International. He's worked in Europe and in the Middle East on emerging democracies. He also is very involved with jazz piano. Okay, too embarrassing. Next panelist is Next panelist is Paul Helfrich. Paul has spent the last 25 years as an educator, researcher, composer, and writer. He specializes in science and technology and is also very interested and has lectured nationally on conscious creation, and integral psychology and spirituality. Our fourth panelist is Chris Mercogliano. Chris has been a teacher since 1973 at the Albany Free School, which is a unique inner-city alternative school. He's an educator and also a writer. He's written essays, commentaries, and reviews. He's also a deacon in the Presbyterian Church. So we have a very diverse set of panelists, and let's begin with Roger Ebert.
I might begin by mentioning that somewhat to the surprise of actually all the members of the panel, there is not a creationist on the panel. And, no. And we, I believe, with the help of our chairman, are going to solicit informed creationist opinions from the audience if any people want to volunteer at some point. Is that correct, more or less?
Yeah.
5 or 6 years ago, there was a creationist here, and I just assumed when I saw that I was on this panel that one of these gentlemen was a creationist, and they all kept looking at me. No, I'm not the creationist. But I am speaking first, not because I'm the expert. Usually the first speaker is the one who proposed the panel and has the most to say. In this case, my job is to just to get on base. If I can get a single, then they're going to try to get me home, because the heavy hitters are coming up a little later. Creationism, if I may be so bold as to speak to it, is a belief that the world as we see it and experience it was created by God, as defined by the creationist that you're speaking to. Darwinism is a theory that the world as we see it and experience it came to pass over a very long period of time through a series of infinitely small steps during which various kinds of beings and flora and fauna came to take their present form on their journey to an ultimate destination that we can only imagine. The key component of Darwinism is time. There has to be a lot of time. And the reason there has to be a lot of time is that the mechanism by which living things reproduce themselves is, for the most part, perfect and never changes from generation to generation. It's binary, and it's more or less flawless. Oddly enough, Darwin wrote and theorized some century before Crick and Watson explained to us the theory of the double helix and explained to us the miracle, if that is what it is, of DNA. DNA is a digital system by which genes reproduce themselves and carry themselves on to the next generation. Richard Dawkins has written a very amusing book called The Selfish Gene, in which he says that we labor under the delusion that we are the star of the show, but to the genes within us, we are simply the vehicle by which they hope to get from the last generation to the next generation. We are merely carriers. The selfish gene wants to survive. It wants to last and reproduce and endure. Dawkins also points out that every single living thing of any description on the face of the earth has only ancestors that successfully reproduced. None of us here, by definition, have a single ancestor that did not successfully reproduce itself, at least in the case of the line leading to us. After that, if that ancestor was hit by a speeding dinosaur or fell off a cliff, that's too bad, but at least the ancestor was able to reproduce, so that we are the result of an unbroken strand of reproduction going back to the first reproduction, which probably involved a one-cell creature that was able to reproduce itself and become a two-cell creature. The reason that DNA needs to be digital is that if it were analog, we would all be pond scum. Because, as you know, if you've copied your analog discs and tapes and LPs over and over again, the more times you copy them, the more they degrade until finally all you have is hiss. And this panel would consist of not only pond scum, but, if I read my Darwinism right, dead pond scum that didn't even successfully manage to continue to be pond scum. A digital reproduction system, like DNA, on the other hand, can reproduce time after time with complete fidelity to its original, which all of you little thieves know as you go onto Napster and steal that music and give it to your friends, and they give it to their friends, and the same record goes 16 times around the earth and is downloaded by 10,000 larcenous college students and still sounds just as good as it did when it started because it's digital. Now, the crucial insight which Darwin had is that occasionally there is an error in copying. Every once in a long while, the digital system, the DNA system, makes a little mistake, either by accident, by carelessness, by external force such as radiation, perhaps, or for some other reason. And that this produces in the next generation a creature subtly different than the creature that begat it. In the vast majority of cases, these new creatures are less successful than their parents, and they do not, in the long run, prevail. In a few cases, they are more successful, and in the long run, they do prevail. And in the competition for life and space and making a living on the planet Earth, their descendants tend to survive better than the descendants of less successful creatures. Now, as these creatures reproduce and subtly change over countless generations, occasionally it should happen that, usually for geographical reasons, two lines of the same species will be separated. Perhaps there is an inland sea, and then the water level drops, and so several separate ponds are created, separated by Earth. Or perhaps continental drift takes continents and pulls them apart from each other to the point where the species on one side can no longer get to the other side. Or perhaps an ocean current manages to influence the migration of the fishes of the sea in such a way that some go in one direction and some go in another. For many generations after they're separated, these species can still breed, could still interact. But the time comes when separate and evolving separately, they can no longer breed with each other. They have become a separate species. The way that that happens can be shown to be true both experimentally, by observation, and by hypothetical experiment in the computer. It is a theory, but it is important for us to understand that in science, a theory is not just something that somebody thinks. A theory is a hypothesis that has withstood the questioning of scientists for as long as it has been out there and has survived, and can be tested and can be reproduced and can be justified by rational thought. A belief, on the other hand, does not need to answer to any of those tests. It need only to be believed in. So that the belief that God created the earth in 6 days and rested on the seventh, or that everything that we see came into existence in the year 4012 BC at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the belief that things that seem to be older than 6,000 years, such as dinosaur bones, are either A, tricks of the devil, or B, God's little practical jokes to mislead us and test our faith. These are all beliefs. The fact is that using carbon dating and the use of what we know about strata in the earth, we're pretty much convinced that those dinosaurs lived a long time ago, and that indeed there seems to be emerging a record in the fossil layers that have been laid down on Earth over the millennium of beings that have gradually evolved, some of them at least, into the beings that we see today, while others, of course, were not successful. The argument for design, which is proposed by the creationists, is an attempt to take their belief and elevate it to the level of a theory so that they can have equal time in the public schools and in public attention. Recently, several IMAX theaters declined to show a movie called Volcanoes of the Deep because it dealt with the very strange creatures that live very, very deep at the bottom of the sea under 1,000 atmospheres of pressure, where there is no light and where there is no oxygen, and where they live by tube worms that are in a symbiotic relationship with bacteria and live by converting sulfurous minerals in heat vents into a form of energy that allows them to live. And this documentary, which used deep sea submersibles to film such creatures, was so bold as to say that it seemed to indicate that life could evolve almost anywhere. Indeed, that there can be life under these conditions at the bottom of the sea. There might be life on some of the moons of other planets in the solar system or other planets elsewhere in the universe, because life apparently can evolve under extremely difficult conditions. This was a theory that some of the IMAX theaters, even though they are run by scientific museums or other scientific organizations, were reluctant to put on their screen because they were afraid they would be picketed by the creationists. By the same token, in the state of Kansas, textbooks have to have a sticker that points out that Darwinism, Darwinian evolution, and creationism are both theories that should have equal weight, and neither one has been proven. And also by the same token, in many school systems, according to a recent article by the New York Times, science teachers have just given up teaching evolution because it's too damn much trouble with all of those people outside picketing them for doing the work of the devil. My purpose on being on this panel, and I'm now going to stop, is to suggest that it's not necessary for you to believe in God to believe in Darwinian evolution, but it's quite possible for you to do so. Indeed, most Christians and most members of all other religions on earth have accepted Darwinian evolution with a great deal of comfort for many centuries. The church had a little trouble at the beginning, but it came around. Right today, it could be said of the late Pope as he lays in state that he was a Darwinian. Because what he would argue for Catholics and most mainstream Protestants and Jews and most of the Eastern religions would argue is that as you look at the theory of evolution as it has been further developed by knowledge about DNA, what you're looking at is the way that God did it, if there is a God. That's how he did it. And you have a choice. Either God, if there is a God, took 4 billion years and created an elegant, complex, and beautiful machinery by which life on earth was given free will to evolve as it would, even to the extreme of producing me. Or you can believe that everything was created at a finite amount of time, a relatively brief time ago, as a magic trick in which God snapped his fingers and brought everything into existence, including things that seem to be older than they should be. Those are your two choices. I believe that it's an insult to God to believe in creationism because it makes him into a trickster rather than giving him the credit for this unbelievably magnificent and sublime mechanism that our human intelligence has revealed to us in terms of Darwinian theory and the workings of DNA. That to have all that knowledge and to have to turn your back on it and say that God just did it is not giving God the benefit of the doubt.
In preparation for this panel, I went to visit some distant cousins in the zoo. I'll tell you, they were really happy to see me. As a matter of fact, they're the ones that taught me how to play piano. The way I look at this debate, and that's what I consider this, it's science versus religion. And, you know, let me state, as I think Roger eloquently did here, the theory of evolution does have enough scientific evidence to justify it in the realm of science. I also believe that there's ample faith in the world to justify the existence of God in religion. And there's also a justification for the relationship between religion and society in a philosophy class, for example. But I don't think evolution, creationism, and the newer form,
argument to intelligent design.
Yeah, intelligent design, belong in science class. And that's one of the dangers that I see. Evolution does have a foundation. It does have the right to exist in real science, and I fully agree that. There are a number of examples, and Roger went through a lot of those, so I'm not going to go through all those. Religion, on the other hand, does not rely on any science, and I think Roger made that point as well. Outside of our desire to somehow explain what we cannot explain scientifically, religion has attempted to do this through creationism and its new strategy, intelligent design. Once again, without evidence, it's hard to call it a science. I do a lot of work in politics. I work in the primaries. Every time the Republicans have a primary, I'm basically all over the country. And I end up in the Midwest quite often. And let me tell you, the creationists, it's a political movement. It's a political movement searching for scientific legitimacy. I spent hours debating this with people that I'm actually helping get elected. And whenever I point to any of their contradictions, I hear things like, "Dan, that's the devil's propaganda." And they're very hard-pressed when I come at them with science to explain it. I've heard things like, well, I'm going to talk to my pastor and I'll come back to you tomorrow. The danger, the way I see it, is we're facing a repeat of 1633, when Galileo was put under house arrest for the blasphemous theory that the earth, in fact, revolved around the sun and not the other way around. Unfortunately for Galileo, his discovery went against church doctrine. And the church had this doctrine that neatly packaged nature's occurrence into a very religion-centric theory, or story, I should say. And it gave the church legitimacy. And then there was Galileo, who was going against this theory. Today, Christian activists are determined to push their views into a form it doesn't belong. And as you do a little research into this, you find some startling evidence in this movement. There's a not-for-profit group called the Discovery Institute that spends millions of dollars each year for research, polls, and media pieces to support intelligent design. Excuse me. Other groups, like the Creation Studies Institute in Florida and the Kentucky group called Answers in Genesis, also do the same thing. Stephen Myers of the Discovery Institute acknowledged in the Washington Post that their goal is, quote, "The idea was to sow doubt about Darwin to buy time for 40-plus scientists affiliated with the Institute to perfect the theory." To me, that's scary. You're looking at a bunch of scientists now being hired not to research real science, but rather their goal is to invent evidence to support some existing agenda. Meanwhile, look at who the Discovery Institute accepts money from. They're wealthy conservatives like Howard Ahimson, Jr., who once said his goal was the total integration of biblical law into our lives. Then there's the Mellon Foundation, which commits itself to the infallibility of Scripture. You know, I'm a firm believer that God and science can coexist, not in the same classroom. There is a book written by David Landis called The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. I highly recommend it to everybody. It is one of the most intriguing books I've ever read. In the book, David Landis talks about why Northern Europe, the Netherlands, and England enjoyed much higher standards of living compared to countries like Spain and Portugal. One primary factor was that in Spain and many Christian countries, higher education was controlled by the church, which retarded the teachings on science. And the Industrial Revolution relied heavily on science, and real science that led to the improvement of our lives. Unfortunately, many Christian universities at the time when the Industrial Revolution was getting off to its start were a little bit behind the curve and refused to teach some of the scientific notions because of religious indoctrination. You know, I was going to speak a little bit about the science behind evolution, although I think this is probably going to be touched on a number of times during our talk today, so I'm going to let our other gentlemen speak to that. But from a political aspect, I think that we do have a little bit to be concerned about. This is turning into a political movement, not merely a scientific one. And I'm fine, you know, if the way I look at it, if God wanted credit for evolution, he would have provided simple man with some hard evidence, maybe a fingerprint and a fossil or something. You know, so I'm thinking maybe he doesn't want credit for it. Maybe he's not that happy with it. So let's honor his wishes. Thank you.